Fabio Vigi teaches Italian and European cinema at Cardiff University in the UK. He is the author of Traumatic Encounters in Italian Film, Zizek, Beyond Foucault, and the upcoming book from Sublation entitled Emergency Capitalism, A Self-Fulfilling Prophecy. Fabio, I am thrilled to introduce you to the Sublation audience and to be publishing your upcoming book. I'm a fan of yours. Thank you.
I'm also very happy to be publishing with you, Doug. It's a great opportunity, and I'm looking forward to this interview too.
Great. So what is emergency capitalism? Let's start
from the beginning. Let's begin from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So emergency capitalism is a concept that I've developed now for about 4 years, obviously starting in 2020. Maybe we can go back to that later. But the overall idea is that we are now in a system which relies on crisis. And it's a debt-based, hyper-financialized system that can only prolong itself, can only continue insofar as it can find alibis or scapegoats, which are traumatic in nature, let's say. So it needs almost an endless series of emergencies, ideally global emergencies, to be able to reproduce itself. So it's really a matter of existential reproduction for the system, almost. It relies on that. And the reason why it relies on emergencies is that it depends very much on credit creation or debt, whichever way you want to look at it. But it relies on the creation of enormous amounts of out of nothing. It's ultimately mouse clicked, as they say, cash that is created out of nowhere on computer screens in banks and especially central banks, the lenders and buyers of last resort. And it's pumped into the hyper-financialized system. But in order for this mechanism to happen, the system requires a kind of rationale. It requires reasons to do it. And the reasons are, as I said, an endless series of events that can be described as emergencies. And I think we've seen a few already over the last 4 years. And there really hasn't been a break. Now we are existentially almost within this paradoxical situation where in order for the system to continue to survive its own crisis, it needs these external emergencies. So emergencies that need to be experienced as some kind of potentially eschatological, cataclysmic, apocalyptic events, which provide alibis for the system to do what it's doing. It's right now even, creating liquidity out of nowhere, creating cash out of nowhere so that to sustain a system that is increasingly unable to sustain itself without these mechanisms.
After the economic crisis of 2008, that is what you're describing is exactly what happened. The state generated fictitious capital out of thin air to make the banks whole.
I know what you mean. It's fundamentally, they invented QE, quantitative easing. And it's interesting also because they said, oh, it's going to be just a temporary measure. We're going to do just one quantitative easing and then we're going to stop. The system is going to go back to normal. We're going to rebalance the system. And then naturally, it will just continue to go where it normally, to do what it normally does. Truth is that there was QE, then QE1, QE2, QE3. Mm-hmm. We ended up with QE infinity, what is known as QE infinity. In other words, the system is existentially dependent on quantitative easing, which is a way of providing the system with the necessary cash it needs to. And it's credit created out of nowhere. It's in the form of debt injected into the system, but it's ultimately created on computer screens. And that's the novelty of our time, that the system can just not stand on its own feet anymore. It needs the constant help of this debt creating or credit creating mechanism.
Now, what is it that I have two questions, so I'm going to ask you the second one first. MMT, modern monetary theory, is, from my way of thinking, and I'm not an expert on it, but is basically advocating for quantitative easing to infinity. It has a theory of money that supposes that you can that through monetary manipulation and the creation of credit and debt, you can manage the contradictions within capitalism indefinitely. And it was popular with the Sanders campaign in the United States. Apparently, Sanders consulted with some MMT theorists on his economic policies. Is stopping quantitative easing to infinity being just an economic policy straight up?
Well, the problem we're facing now is that because we relied so much on credit creation, because it's not the first time that we've been doing it for too long, we've created so much money that is not produced by the system itself, it's externally produced, by literally out of nowhere. And that creates, by itself, creates inflation. It devalues the currency. If you add so much currency to the system, even if it's just to inflate the bubbles, the financial bubbles, eventually still translates as fiat currency devaluation. Mm-hmm. So the problem with MMT, I think, is the same problem that we have with what we call deficit spending or Keynesianism, right? The idea that, yeah, we can borrow money. As long as we invest it properly, we should be able to kickstart the economy again. But it's too late now. And the system no longer responds to that logic. The main reason for me is that the real economy is no longer productive. It's no longer as productive as it used to be. And there's an imminent, I think we've discussed it before, there's an imminent reason for it. The reason is that automation is replacing value-producing labor. So within the capitalist real economy, hence the necessity for the system to produce profits, not through its original formula, but through financialization, which eliminates the mediation of labor, because it's simply money creating more money, right? The system is existentially tied to the creation of money out of money itself, without necessarily labor as a mediator. So MMT, as well as various forms of Keynesianism and post-Keynesianism, are out of time. They don't realize that the system has moved on and the real economy is no longer productive to the point that the system needs it to be productive. It's no longer productive to support the system. And it's pretty obvious. If you look at national debts, it's pretty obvious that these debts are growing exponentially. There's no way of stopping them, precisely because the returns from the real economy are not even enough to pay the interest of the public debt or the national debt. So the system requires, it's almost like an addict requiring more and more toxic drugs, essentially, right, to carry on, or methadone, or however you want to put it. It requires external measures to make it function. And so we are now totally dependent on fictitious capital. That's the point. Totally dependent on fictitious capital. There's no way we can reignite a value productive economy, because the value productive economy is based on intensive labor, intensive exploitation of labor. With the levels of technological innovation that we have today, from the third industrial revolution in the 70s to the fourth industrial revolution that is actually happening now with artificial intelligence, it's impossible to achieve the amount of value necessary for the reproduction of our societies. So that's an imminent reason. Mm-hmm. It's got nothing to do with people being good or bad. Managing the system. It's not about a matter of managing the system. It's the system itself that is self-destroying. It's slowly collapsing because it follows blindly its own internal logic, right? Profit-making is the only thing that matters to capital, obviously. It's about the self-reproduction of itself. It's not about socializing people, communities, etc. It's about...
So let me interject if I've got this right. No trouble. So... you have the quantitative easing that came out of 2008. It was supposed to be a one-time measure, but it happened again and again. It is through the state and in various mechanisms, simply the printing of money to and the lowering of interest rates in order to inject capital and inject money into various capitalist enterprises to keep investment and production going, right? It's just real simple terms. And the idea was, if we do this, then the production will keep going and then it will be profitable and the loans, these are basically loans, will be paid back and there won't be a problem. But the difficulty was is that even then, the rate of profit or the rate of the production of the surplus, which are two different things, was so low because of automation that the fictitious capital produced inflation instead of just setting the system right. And so with the inflation, you would have difficulty basically buying raw materials for production and also have getting people gainfully employed because the wages would have to either go up or the workers wouldn't be able to reproduce themselves. Just all sorts of difficulties arose around inflation. So that led to the rising interest rates, which meant that you couldn't get private industry to borrow the capital that you were fictitious capital that you were introducing into the market. And so they had to come up with reasons for the state to borrow from itself in order to do something with the money that the fictitious capital that was being produced. And that's why there was this emergency capitalism arose. Is that correct?
I think first of all, the quantitative easing was the target of quantitative easing was mostly to keep the financial markets afloat. So to avoid an explosion in the financial markets, which would have translated as a destruction also of the real economy, because by 2008, I would argue even earlier, the real economy was already had already been cannibalized or colonized by fictitious capital. So the real economy itself runs on borrowed money. And the borrowed money in the form of bonds or whatever is then placed on markets and it's packaged into different, as we know, different types of financial assets, which are exchanged 100 times and then they turn into derivatives, etc. So it's really a kind of pyramid of hot air, right? There's nothing in it. There's just a promise of future valorization eventually. So that's the way in which the financial markets predates or cannibalizes the real economy. And this is a mechanism that has been in place for a long time. So what I'm trying to say is that the economy as we understand it today is disproportionately the financial system. It's the center of gravity of what we call the capitalist economy today is the financial market. So the number one preoccupation of policymakers, etc., is to make sure that financial markets, that there isn't a violent downturn in financial markets, because that would really be traumatic for the whole of society, because we are connected, existentially connected to financial markets. So when you're talking about quantitative easing, ultimately the purpose was to keep those markets pumped with liquidity and allow those markets to expand again. And after COVID, of course, the system has been pumped with a lot of liquidity, so has been made liquid again, with a lot of cash. And today we are in a situation where, again, the paradox we're living today, we have a number of countries, Japan, the UK, other countries that are actually in recession, technically, and yet their financial markets are breaking record highs all the time. And that's the decoupling I'm talking about. What really matters, we need to realize that what really matters to what we call the elite is the protection of speculation, the protection of financial assets. The bubbles can't pop. If the bubbles pop, all hell breaks loose. That's the number one preoccupation. And I think even when we think about geopolitics, we should always go back to think about this context, that everything that takes place around us today is deeply connected with the health, in inverted commas, of financial markets, because they have become the economy. They have become the center of the economy. That doesn't mean that workers don't matter anymore. Of course they do. Commodity needs to be produced, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. There needs to be consumption and so on and so forth. But there's a massive distortion within the system insofar as capital is created, whether you consider it fictitious or not, capital is created in financial markets more than in the real economy. And because financial markets are now much more profitable than the real economy. So capitals flow naturally, spontaneously into the stock markets and the bond markets, et cetera, and any other kind of market that is speculative in nature.
So I tend to think about the world through movies. I try to think about the world through books and literature and art, but I often enough just, it's Hollywood movies. And there are two movies that came to mind while you were describing this. One was Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts, and I forget the guy's name.
Richard Gere.
And the other is Wall Street with Michael Douglas.
Oh, yeah.
Martin Sheen and Charlie Sheen and Daryl Hannah from Mermaid and Splash. But anyhow, in both those movies, the plot, there's a primary plot. Usually it's like a love story, or in Pretty Woman, certainly it's a love story. But the background plot is that you have these Wall Street types that are going around basically buying up real capital, real businesses, and just turning them into assets for financial speculation. They're destroyers of worlds, these Wall Street tycoons.
So what do you do?
I buy companies.
What kind of companies?
I buy companies that are in financial difficulty.
Dad promised you must get them for a bargain, huh?
Well, the company I'm buying this week, I'm getting for the bargain price of about $1
billion. So you don't actually have $1 billion, huh?
No, I get some of it from banks, investors. It's not an easy thing to do.
And you don't make anything?
No.
And you don't build anything?
No.
So what do you do with the companies once you buy them?
I sell them.
Here, let me do that. You sell them?
Well, I don't sell the whole company. I break it up into pieces, and then I sell that off. It's worth more than the whole.
So it's sort of like stealing cars and selling them for the parts, right?
We can look back as far back as like 1987 and see what you're talking about as far as the financial sector getting out of control. And that sort of defines neoliberalism, which is associated, of course, with the Reagan era, the 80s.
Yes.
But what also is associated with that time is the destruction of domestic production and the globalization of the economy and the seeking of cheap labor overseas. We have Wall Street comes out in 87. A movie like Roger and Me, made by Michael Moore, comes out in 89, which is all about the destruction of this automobile GM town, Flint, Michigan, as the jobs move from Flint to Mexico. So this is a story that's familiar, but what you're saying is that it's reached a fever pitch, that somehow or another, the aim of, it's pretty usual for a business to borrow money for next year's production. So you borrow money, short-term loans or long-term loans, with the idea of taking the money, investing in production, and paying back the loan. And then you have all sorts of financial instruments that build on top of that basic transaction. But what you're saying is like the trading of speculative assets based on future production is pretty much a huge percentage of the economy. It takes up a huge space in the economic world.
Yeah, look at world economy. They are either stagnant or in recession or growing very little. Even China slowed down a lot. So even those economies that we thought of over the last years, that there's a lot of potential there in the real economy, in the labor-based economy, even those economies are starting to slow down. And it's not just, and here you have two schools of thought, right? You think, okay, it's the Gordon Geckos of this world, that it's greed that has taken over, right? Greed has taken over capitalism, as if capitalism wasn't greedy by definition. Right. This is the point that people miss when they think, when they personalize guilt, right? It's not just the Gordon Geckos of this world. It's the system that is intrinsically greedy. So it goes, capital goes wherever it can accumulate itself more quickly. If the real economy is no longer so productive in terms of capital, then capital will move in financial market. That's what it's been doing over the last 50 years, I argue, probably starting in the 80s, really, maybe even a little earlier. I argue that it coincides with the third industrial revolution, where we have all of a sudden microelectronics. And I'm not the only one arguing that, by the way. There's a lot of people. There's a very ample literature of thinkers who have underlined this. It's an imminent movement. It's got nothing to do with subjectivities, with greedy characters. Of course, it needs the greedy characters too to drive that logic towards the financialization of the economy. But it's intrinsic within the capitalist system, right? If it cannot profit from productive economy, from labor, mm-hmm. it will profit from speculation. And I argue that neoliberalism and financialization of the economy was essentially almost like a compensatory move away from the growing lack of productivity of the real economy. That's my argument. And I think now we are the point of no return in a way. We cannot go back to those days where the economy was so productive. Because why was it productive? Because it was labor intensive. Because a lot of labor was employed in commodity production, which is really what creates value in capitalist terms, commodity production. Now it's machines producing commodities. Mm-hmm. Hence, really, it's just a very elementary application of Marxian theory. Hence, you, as a capitalist, produce less and less value. Value not only in economic terms, but also in social terms. Value as a social relation, as a relation that socializes labor and capital, right? So I think we are outside that framework now. And there's no way we can go back to that world.
I think I agree with everything you're just saying, but I want to go through it again just to see if I'm getting it right. So the idea of capitalism is that everyone can be greedy. In fact, that's how it's supposed to work, right? Adam Smith talked about how private interests become public goods and through the hidden hand of the market. Right. And so what's good about capitalism is the way that it creates individual interests and lets people pursue their own happiness, and in a way where it doesn't have to be hierarchical or centralized or run by some authority, but everyone working in their own interests, producing, will create a better world for everybody. That's the idea. But then I had a friend who was a Marxist who used to say, you know, there is a hidden hand of the market, but there's also a hidden foot. And the hidden foot is that this, what happens is what you're describing, where the more efficient you become, the faster you can produce things, the more machines you use, and it's called constant capital in Marxist terms or in economic terms, that is deployed, then the more likely you are to have trouble in terms of making a profit. The market will start to break down. And why is that? Why is it the faster we make things, the more efficient we are at producing things? The less work we have to do to make the world, the more trouble we get in the market, the less profits we make. Why is that happening?
It's a crazy thing, right? From my angle, automation and technological innovation is intrinsically a blessing. It's a blessing in disguise. But because it's attached to the capitalist formula, mm-hmm. it drives us down. It creates depression. It creates stagnation. And it forces capitalism into the financial market, mm-hmm. which are increasingly, that's a different story, but increasingly distorted by central banks, et cetera, you know. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the basic formula is money, labor, capital. Money invested into labor creates capital through the exploitation mm-hmm. of labor. Surplus labor time creates surplus value mm-hmm. for the capitalist, but at the same time, it socializes laborers. It creates mm-hmm. a society out of that formula. And so we've seen that develop over the last, 200 years, maybe. Even though we've maybe experienced it at its heights, mostly in the post-war period, right? From the 50s up to the 80s, the glorious 30s, the 30 years of post-war, where there was a degree of redistribution of capital, laborers fought for their rights, and there was a kind of rebalancing of that greed in a way. But then let's not forget that happened mostly at the center, the capitalist center. It's not everywhere in the world, of course. Mm-hmm. So there was still huge exploitation elsewhere, obviously, whilst with this. But anyway, the point being that the formula works for capital as well as for workers to an extent, only insofar as workers are employed. If machines are employed, you don't produce capital in capitalist, you don't produce value in capitalist terms anymore. That it you don't, because it's very simple. You don't pay productive workers anymore. You can't pay productive workers. You pay machines. But machines don't walk down to the supermarket to buy the goods, right? Mm-hmm. That's the image that we could use to simplify it a little. So they don't consume, and therefore they don't realize the profits for the capitalists. And there's no way in which you can create an economy where capitalists and workers somehow cooperate. The result of this is the financialization of the economy. And it's an inherently, it creates inherent distortions. When money is created out of nowhere and thrown at the financial markets, but also at state finances, mm-hmm. and it's employed, of course, in deficit spending, for example, to create conditions for citizens, decent conditions for people to live in, that is not part of the original formula of capitalism. That is the financialization of capitalism. It's extreme financialization. So we end up with these massive distortions. These distortions are emerging today, I would argue, that they've been emerging strongly over the last few years as the devaluation of fiat currencies, right? Fiat currencies that are no longer tied to gold. They can be created, by banks out of nowhere. And that act in itself creates potentially the devaluation of currencies. And this is the phenomenon of our time. Fiat currencies are collapsing slowly but surely. And obviously what's collapsing with them is the capitalist society as well, because currencies are supposed to be stores of value. But precisely because they are fiat currencies, they are less and less stores of value. They're just money. The money can be created out of nowhere, and therefore potentially meaningless money, money with less and less value.
So why is it if the difficulty is that these robots that everyone's hiring,
yeah,
whether it's AI or just old fashioned robots that weld and things like that, the problem is that these robots don't receive a wage and then thereby don't purchase the consumer items that are being produced, why wouldn't something like a universal basic income or a universal job guarantee, a wage guarantee, be the solution rather than quantitative easing? If you could just redirect the money that's being produced, or actually, I guess it would be alongside quantitative easing. You create this fictitious capital, but then you put it into the pockets of workers through a basic income, or you give everyone some sort of job, even if it's just passing papers back and forth about how the AIs are doing, then you will have the money to go and realize the value that's being produced
the machines have created. Well, the problem is that not all jobs, first of all, are value producing. The production of value is strictly related to production of commodities. So that's why industrial capitalism is the sort of the highest phase of value-producing capital, because there really you have workers producing commodities and then being given a salary to purchase those commodities they've produced and therefore realizing profits out of surplus value, right? That's the kind of the way in which it's supposed to work in capitalist terms. If you start by saying, okay, we let machines produce commodities as much as they want, people don't need to work anymore, they can stay at home in front of the television, but we need to provide them with some capital to spend, right? Or at least some mm-hmm. money to spend, mm-hmm. buy commodities to survive and so on and so forth. But first of all, where does this money come from? And your point is quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. So it's already the financialization of the economy we're talking about. In a sense, we are already there. We're mm-hmm. already at that point, right? Where there isn't enough liquidity in the system, you need to get it out. You need to get it from out of nowhere, quite literally. Quantitative easing, ultimately, it's money created out of nowhere
Just printing money.
Printing money is the phrase that everybody understands, right? In truth, mm-hmm. they don't really print it anymore. They just mouse click it. They mouse click mm-hmm. it on their computers, and then mm-hmm. they use it to purchase assets, normally bonds, like treasuries, mm-hmm. from the market. And obviously, by purchasing those assets, they inject money into the market, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't come from within the system. It's not part of this kind of pseudo-natural balance or pseudo-natural connection between labor and capital. I'm saying pseudo-natural because, of course, it's not natural. It's a fiction. It's been created. Mm-hmm. But it's out of nowhere. If we go back to the origins, mm-hmm. somebody decided this could work. This formula could work. Let's try it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it started to work. It took centuries. Right. Mm-hmm. For a while, it overlapped with the feudal system, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. But it then managed to take root and to develop historically and socially, socialize the world. The problem is if we start to finance UBI, for example, the question is, how do we finance UBI, universal benefit, basic income? Mm-hmm. How do we finance it if we cannot finance it from the system? If there's not enough value in the system to finance, if we cannot finance it through taxation, through revenues, right? Because the idea would mm-hmm. be, oh, maybe we can tax the super rich or whatever to finance UBI.
Mm-hmm.
But there's big problems related to that. First of all, how do you chase the super rich? We know where they put their money. It's very difficult to get them to pay tax. Mm-hmm. But even that, revenues are no longer enough to reproduce our societies. Revenues alone today are merely used to cover the interest on the deficit. It unfortunately, the system is so dependent on fictitious capital created out of nowhere that it's very difficult to think of a sustainable way of having automated production in capitalist terms. The distortions are enormous. We end up with a devaluation of money. Also, don't forget that the financial sector is like a black hole. The more money you throw at it, the more money it needs to sustain itself, because these bets and side bets constantly multiply. And then they multiply into the derivative galaxy. Derivative galaxy is, nobody exactly knows how many quadrillions of dollars there are in mm-hmm. derivatives alone. So mm-hmm. it's really, you know, the image of a mountain of paper built on some kind of extremely volatile substance. It's so dangerous. It's also very difficult to manage it, right? And today we are seeing how difficult it is, because that's part of my argument. You constantly need these emergencies to establish some kind of balance within the system, where you can raise your rates a little bit, make money a little bit more expensive. But now we know that this is not going to work for very long. Mm-hmm. We need to find reasons to bring those interest rates down, like they did during COVID. And they will need to do that now again with this escalation of war escalation, I think. There will be some kind of incident, not necessarily a third world war. I don't think mm-hmm. that's going to happen, but there will be an escalation, dangerous enough, and also portrayed by the media in such a way that it will convince everybody that, you know, those measures have to be taken. And in terms of making money cheap again, why are they making money cheap again? Because the financial system can only sustain itself through cheap money, through injections of mountains of cheap money. Sorry.
You didn't digress at all. You set up a great transition, a segue, because now I think we need to, for the people who want to watch what we're going to talk about next, they need to go over to Rumble, because we're going to be talking about things that the state doesn't want us to talk about. We could talk about economics all day long and nobody cares and it's all abstract. But now we're going to talk about how these states of emergency are constructed and why and we've gone over why. But we'll continue recording here. But everyone should know that your YouTube is under the control of the state. And because of that, we can't speak as freely here as we might want to. But you can become an enlightened wonder over. I'm sorry, I'm becoming Russell Brand. But go over onto Rumble and you can watch the rest of it there. Cool. All right. So now, Fabio,
yeah.
if you do watch, I mentioned Russell Brand a second ago. If you do watch Russell Brand, he did a show recently where he was predicting, Ron Paul had predicted that there would be a black swan event. Mm-hmm. Russell Brand frequently covers all the ways in which the pandemic brought along state censorship and also censorship of information that might have led people to be skeptical about the severity of the disease, the necessity for vaccination amongst young people, the effectiveness of masking, on and on, the origins of the virus. All of these things are things that Russell Brand will talk about. We're not actually meant to talk about them in polite company, but let's be impolite here. And what do you think the pandemic really was?
Yeah, I obviously I've done a bit of research about it, a bit of a deep dive into the origins of the pandemic. And I argue that the pandemic has a monetary cause, right? So if you want to look for the cause why we had a pandemic, look into follow the money, right? Yeah, my point, but basic point is follow the money. Where was the money going at the time? And I'm not just talking about profitability, because obviously pandemic was also extremely profitable for the pharmaceutical industry, for example. We all know that. We can talk about things like that, I guess. This is something that this is fine to talk about, that the profitability of the greedy guys, that's fine. But I think there was a systemic issue at its heart, right? The system itself was about to collapse again in 2019. And this was quite well known already in the summer of 2019. There are documents from the Bank of International Settlements, which is the central bank of central banks, the most powerful central banks ever, based in Switzerland, in Basel. It's a very mysterious entity, even in legal terms, right? There's a book that has been written on the role of the Bank of International Settlements during the Second World War, which is very interesting. Adam Libor is the writer. I think it's called The Tower of Basel, because that's where the headquarters of the bank are. But the point is that the bank, the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and other entities knew that the system was approaching a new 2008, essentially. A new, again, QE after QE, the bubbles were becoming unsustainable. And they tried in 2017, 2018 to see if they could change their monetary policy, go from a QE to a QT, so a quantitative tightening rather than having a quantitative easing, meaning reducing the quantity of assets that central banks held, because they reached the limits. The interest rates were down to zero, and then in some cases were even negative. So you can't go any lower than that. And yet the system demanded more and more liquidity, more and more. It needed to be made liquid, to be kept liquid somehow. Mm-hmm. So it needed more cash to be thrown at it. So in September 2019, we have the repo market crisis that not many people talked about, but those who knew how dangerous it was took notice of it, as it were. Mm-hmm. The repo market is a kind of shadow banking. It's part of the shadow banking system where you can just raise money very cheaply normally with the promise of repaying it. Normally it's within 24 hours, but it can be also within a week or a month or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in exchange for the money you borrow, you give a collateral, which is normally bonds, treasuries, USDs, US treasuries, right? And the problem was that in the middle of September, I think it was September 11th, by the way, which is an interesting coincidence. That's when it started. Sometimes weird coincidence. But anyway, let's leave it like that. September 11th, 12th, 2019, the rates of these transactions in the repo market went from 2% to 10%, more or less. Mm-hmm. And that kind of froze immediately the borrowing market, right? So all of a sudden, there was a lack of money, lack of cash, lack of liquidity, which threatened a mega massive contagion across the board, throughout the sector, the financial sector, everywhere else, not only in the shadow banking system. Let's not forget that the shadow banking system today moves a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. More or less 50% of all financial assets, right? So it's very important. It's not much talked about, but it's very important. It's less regulated than the financial system we all know. It's where investors go when they need money quickly and on the cheap. Because can you imagine a drug addict who needs a fix in a hurry? He goes to the shadow banking system, because there you can get it also with good interest rates normally. But in September 2019, rates spiked massively. And the Fed immediately reacted. You can imagine how it reacted, just by throwing as much money as possible, because it was like a fire that you needed to throw water on, and very quickly. And they did it nonstop every week, billions of dollars, blah, blah, blah. But the fire didn't go out. It continued, and the threat was always there. So then at this stage, I don't really know exactly if this fire in the repo market, this repocalypse, as it was known at the time, was a natural event or was some kind of non-natural event. It was caused by maybe intentionally. I don't know. The truth is that what happens afterwards, it's, you know, for me, it's very significant insofar as we get virus, we get COVID. With COVID, COVID was almost like a shield that allowed the central bank to throw inordinate amounts of money at the system, right? So it created trillions out of nowhere. Initially, we didn't know exactly how much it created, but then, of course, it had to make it public. And a few years down the line, we know that we're talking about like 40, 50 trillion in loans, of course. But essentially liquidity, the system was made liquid again at a time when they were running out of solutions. They were running out of rabbits to take out of the hat. And COVID allowed them to do what they wanted to do, essentially, right? To make that financial system whole again, at least for a short time, for the short period. So it created the, and that, for me, that was the classic case of emergency capitalism, right? You weaponize a virus, literally or not, you weaponize the fact that there might be a pandemic in order to sort out a monetary problem, which is existential for the system, right? It's a crucial monetary problem. And for me, that's maybe is the perfect example for what I mean by emergency capitalism.
There are a couple of things about the COVID pandemic that for me made it very unique, like world historic. And I think that we forget about them over time, especially in the United States, because we're so egocentric. We only think about our own nation. But the reality was that it was the first time in my lifetime that I could see something happen that was truly global and that was dealt with the same way globally, right, or seemed to be dealt with the same way globally. The Beatles, they became a big worldwide sensation, but they weren't popular in France. But the pandemic,
popular in France too.
Popular in France,
and also everyone was all the political leaders were instructed to read from the same script. They were literally repeating the same things, right? Literally reading, doing exactly, okay, with some small variations and changes, which, you know, had to make it more realistic, but ultimately they were all implementing the same measures and also the same kind of authoritarian measures, right? With some differences, of course, because if you were
there were some there, like in Brazil, there was some skepticism, but the policies were actually put in place, even in places where skepticism was expressed by leaders. Yeah, that is remarkable. And it's especially remarkable in a context of a world right now where we're apparently supposed to be at war east and west. Like, it's supposed to be
good.
Different.
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Excellent point. Because whether you were in Russia or in China or in the US or in the West more generally, same measures in China, lockdowns in Italy, lockdowns in France, in Germany, the freezing of the economy and the pumping of all these money created out of nowhere into the financial sector, mostly. Obviously, some went also to people who were not allowed to work, but mostly into the financial sectors. Financial sector needed that. I think it needed that. Those injections. Again, the metaphor of injecting liquidity is an interesting one here, because ultimately it's got to do with the monetary system. But I think that's a classic case of emergency capitalism. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that the leaders knew it before that this was going to happen, or at least certainly the big banks. There were already papers by BlackRock, for example, especially by BlackRock, suggesting that unconventional measures had to be taken in order to pump more money into the system. Essentially, I'm cutting a long story short, but it's remarkable. So what I did, I went through the stages. I went through all these papers and I think proved that they were looking for a scapegoat. Let's put it like that. They were looking for a reason, an alibi to implement these measures that had already been prepared in advance.
And you look through the records, these are public records?
They're the public records. You can find them. It's the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS. It's the Federal Reserve, of course, is BlackRock, documents that BlackRock produced. And they all suggest growing panic. That's my takeaway. When you read them, you think they know that something bad is happening. The system is no longer able to reproduce itself. They've gone as far as they could with quantitative easing. Now they need something to create a crisis, essentially, so that they can refill the system, right?
What did they say particularly, like, about a crisis? Or how? Walk me through it slowly, because I understand, but I think there's a bit here that I'm missing. When the pandemic hit, it shut down production, but it also allowed the banks to do what? To create more, print more money? Is that what
you're talking about? Yeah, it's all this. We think about, let's take the example of the Federal Reserve, right? This is the most powerful central bank in the world. So the Federal Reserve has the power of, why is it so powerful? Because it can create dollars out of nowhere, quite literally. And the dollar, the US dollar, is still obviously the global reserve. So it's the one that everybody needs, or most people need, to transact. And if you want to buy oil, you need dollars, petrodollars, and so on and so forth. The Federal Reserve, how does the Federal Reserve connect with the markets, for example, or with the economy? It has a list of primary dealers, which are financial institutions, banks, etc., that mediate between the central bank and the financial sector more widely, and also the real economy. Because once these primary dealers get the money from the Fed, they can then allocate it. They can then allocate it, is the wrong word. They can then borrow it, lend it to whoever they
want.
Allocation. Right?
That's
so,
kind of allocation. Yeah,
yeah, allocation. It's the kind of allocation. So that's what we've had for a long time, of course. But with COVID, we had, when you look at what the Fed did, it really did create trillions, and then it lent it to primary dealers. At the same time, it also found, it's a very complicated way to understand it now, but it also found a way to put that money that it created out of nowhere directly into the hands of those who needed it. So it even bypassed the traditional way of doing quantitative easing. So this was a kind of quantitative easing on steroids. It's been called quantitative easing on steroids because it was, in fact, if you think about the BlackRock strategy, which already emerged in the summer of 2019, it was known as going direct. The title of it, I think it was even the title of the policy, going direct, meaning finding a way. And they say it almost as I'm saying it now, it's verbatim almost. They say we need to find a way to get all the money that we're going to print directly into the hands of those private and public entities who need it, right? So that's the way that I'm actually quoting out of from memory.
And those would be like pretty much big tech companies, manufacturers.
Anybody who needs it because they need to refinance their debts, they need to stay afloat within the system. And let's not forget that by 2019, the system was already populated by a very high number of zombie companies, for example, companies that couldn't refinance themselves. And once again, we go back to this very kind of counterintuitive idea of the financial market being a black hole. Literally, it sucks cash as if there was no tomorrow. It's a constant sucking of it. It needs it more and more in order to play it's betting games, right? In derivative markets, et cetera, et cetera. I think with COVID, we had an example, a kind of QE on steroids, essentially. That sentence from BlackRock really sums it up, because BlackRock was then employed by the Fed to get them out of trouble. This is the crazy thing, right? The Fed is supposed to be a public entity. It's not really a public entity, but in the collective imaginary, it is a public entity, right? It's linked to the Treasury, et cetera, et cetera. But then the Fed employs a private, maybe the most powerful private institution in the world now, BlackRock, in order to sort out the economic issue that they had.
So how did they connect it to COVID when they were going direct? What kinds of things would they say?
COVID, they stopped the economy, right? People couldn't, at least not completely, obviously, but they froze the economy. And therefore, they needed to get money into people's account.
Okay,
so they not just ordinary people. Ordinary people got some money, of course, as well. And this is one of the causes that exacerbated inflation when they reopened, obviously, because all of a sudden you had money that you didn't produce through labor. You were just given that money. And that's, so we go back to one of those distortions that we were talking about earlier. Quantitative easing, especially directly, done directly as during COVID, creates distortions.
It's inevitable. Like in the UK, I understand that the government guaranteed wages for workers who were not working and that their jobs would continue. And that was part of aid package, basically, that was sent directly to different companies in the UK. And it was not only those wages, but they were also given enough money to, I don't know, do what exactly. But in the United States, if you were running a restaurant, you could apply for aid. I'm not sure if it came in the form of loans or not, but that and they did that on both a need-based
loans. Yes, it is loans. But these were crumbs in respect to what. Or how much money the central banks were creating. Crumbs. It's only crumbs that went to ordinary people like us.
Or middle-class people who have businesses.
Or even middle-class people who have business, etc. The big money went to the financial institutions, the big banks, that were more and more involved in risky speculations, volatile speculations, that they didn't know how to get that money anymore, because the system had reached a point of no return once again. Interest rates were down to zero almost. There was no way they could get more money into the system. They had to find another way of doing it, an unconventional measure. So they are actually saying we need unconventional monetary policy. And they're saying it in June 2019 and then again in August 2019. They're preparing for this. They're preparing for these unconventional measures. And then COVID comes, the virus arrives, almost miraculously, right? So either you believe that it's a miracle or a crazy coincidence that allowed the powers that be to execute the plan that had already prepared. Start thinking that maybe there's some kind of connection with something else, that maybe it wasn't just accidental, that maybe they've exaggerated something that was already there. Or maybe they.
What do you?
First of all, I don't have a definitive answer. I know that there was something. You know, there was a virus. There was something that, if I say there was a virus, some people will hate me because there's a lot of people who don't believe in viruses. Okay, I don't know what it was, whether it was a virus or something else. Let's not say virus. Let's say there was a disease, right? Something that was a problem for our health. They massively exaggerated it. They've created a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more they were talking about, obviously the media were all compliant. They were all responsible for creating this panic. And then it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let me tell you the limited hangout theory of COVID, right? This is basically the kinds of things that you can find if you read the newspapers carefully and you sort through what the information is really out there. They got the infection rate wrong. They didn't realize how infectious it would be. It was at first, apparently. And they way overestimated the rate of mortality. They like it by a factor of 300% or something like that.
Yeah.
So rather than being 3.4% of the population who got infected, of the infected population dying, it was more like 0.1 or 0.2%, something like that. Yeah. And so that's known. So then your theory would be that, and also the lockdowns were known. There was certainly a lot of dissent about whether or not the lockdowns and freezing the economy was the best policy given both the rate of infection And if you think it is 3.4% mortality, it's still not really sure that lockdowns were even effective in slowing the spread. So your theory, just from a limited hangout perspective, would be, yes, and they knew all those things, but opportunistically oversold the threat of COVID or their ability to do something about it through lockdowns.
Yeah.
In order to justify an economic policy
yeah.
of massive quantitative easing
yeah.
around the globe, not just for
going
one
going direct around the, so there again, it's a global thing. And we know that the markets are globally connected. If something goes wrong in China, we feel it here. We feel the pain here. If there's a market crash in the housing bubble in China, all of a sudden we are in trouble and vice versa. So at that level, we are all connected, despite the fact that we might make war to each other politically, geopolitically, strategically, and so on and so forth. At that level of financial kind of, you know, massive, at that height, we are connected. So that would explain why they all went down the same road in tackling the virus, for me, because they all knew that they couldn't afford the system to, or they needed this. But the other thing is, I know a lot of people would agree with us with what we just said now, mm-hmm. that there was a massively exaggerated reaction to mm-hmm. whether in terms of lockdowns or shutting down the economy, etc. It was not needed, not necessary. So there must have been another reason to do it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people saying that it was a matter of greedy people, once again, bad people, wanting to eliminate the middle classes, for example, wanting to destroy the middle classes. And obviously the working classes were already doing pretty badly, but now it's about the middle classes. And obviously the lockdowns destroyed a lot of small and medium enterprises, for example, and so on and so forth. That's certainly the case. I think that's part of the plan, but it's not the main driver, as far as I'm concerned. The main driver, if we were in an economy still where the middle classes were creating enough value and enough productivity and so on and so forth, then they would never have gone for lockdowns, because the middle class would have still been the driver of our economy. So they need to protect them. But for me, the main problem and the main cause is the monetary one. Really, we need to look at the financial system, and we need to look how in the shape it was in 2019 after 11 years of quantitative easing, essentially. Because Ben Bernanke started right in 2008, and he said, okay, it's going to be a temporary measure, quantitative easing, we'll do it just once. But then, as I said earlier, it turned into infinity QE, never mm-hmm. stopped. And the system became dependent on it, literally like a drug addict, dependent mm-hmm. on this mechanism.
Yeah.
So it got to a point where the mechanism could not be reproduced any longer without a potential explosion of the bubble. Let's call it the bubble, the everything bubble. Mm-hmm. And so they needed a crisis to refill the system in a way that they could buy more time. They could buy more time for the system. Obviously, because all this going direct, all this money creation and injections into the system has bought the system more time. But I argue that now we are very quickly going back to the same point.
Listen, your book is coming out this year. I forget if we said September or somewhere around that time, August maybe.
Not 11th, right?
Not September. It's coming out on September 11th. And you're going to come back on to the podcast and onto these channels again. You'll be on Rumble. You'll be on the main YouTube channel. And we can talk about a variety of things that we only skimmed over today in future episodes.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important to, if we accept this notion of emergency capitalism, we'll have to take a look at the war in Ukraine,
right?
The war in Israel, between Israel and Gaza,
yes.
and a variety of other topics like the rising tensions with China, the changes in the monetary system. Apparently the dollar exactly. may no longer be the global currency, or at least there's some grumbling about that.
CBDCs, the idea that this kind of centralized digital currency, it's in preparation and might replace the current monetary system. I think this is probably the end game
mm-hmm.
Down the line. It's not happening tomorrow, but I think that's planned. At some point, they might be able to do it. If there's a crisis that is bad enough, that people will beg for anything, would beg for digital money, even if that means control, essentially, on anything you do. So the centralization of the system, I think the wars are very important. It's a really interesting topic to discuss, the fact that we are heading towards inevitable escalations of conflicts.
But we don't need to buy gold or make sure that we have vitamin drinks to make us strong, right? We've got to do something else, because these kinds of remedies aren't gonna get us.
No, they're gonna. No, I think vitamin D is not bad. We can protect a little bit. I don't mind vitamin D at all. Gold is not bad either. It gives you a little bit of protection. If the money continues to devalue at the current rate, it's a good hedge against. But obviously, they're not a solution. And right. Certainly, Bitcoins. We can think of Bitcoin as well. A lot of money is moving into Bitcoin and gold at the moment, incidentally. Mm. So people know that the system is again quite shaky, despite the fact that it's reaching record highs. If you think about the S&P 500, mm-hmm. you look at, again, it's interesting because S&P 500 breaking records, but it's who's driving the bubble, who's inflating the bubble is two or three companies, Nvidia, Meta, and all the other companies are more or less zombie companies. So again, we're back.
Yeah, the stock market's roaring as the media class.
The idea of the Magnificent Seven, the big sort of tech mania that we have at the moment with AI driving it. But again, it's just a bunch of companies, just three or four mega companies that are driving it. So again, it's much more shaky than it seems on the surface. And the fact that a lot of money is moving into cryptos and into precious metals, especially obviously gold, it's a symptom that people realize, particularly banks, because it's central banks buying a lot of gold, stocking a lot of gold. Realize that the financial sector is not as safe as it seems, and that the popping of the bubbles is always around the corner in a way, potentially. And again, I think there's a geopolitics of crisis now that is mostly a geopolitics of, again, financial crisis, I think, monetary crisis. I think to understand what is going on in these wars, you need to always look at the context. At the financial context. Otherwise, it don't make sense. Otherwise, it just becomes, again, a distraction. The baddies, the goodies, and so on and so forth. I think they are deeply connected with the economy, and particularly the financialized economy. But maybe this is a topic we can discuss another time.
Yeah, we'll talk about it more in the next episode. We'll have to come up with a branding around the Fabio Hour. Maybe we'll call it.
But I'd really love to be able to talk about this a bit more in depth, because I think it's important that people open their minds and don't just believe the media, right? Because the media, they will always try to distract them. Whereas we, as a different kind of media, will tell them where to look, right?
Yes, what I aim to do. I try to get underneath the surface. All right, I'm going to stop the recording there, but thank you, Fabio, for the first episode of Is It the Fabio Hour? Is it COVID was a lie? We'll find out what the name will be next time.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.